uncontained SCPs. Secure, contain, protect. Despite the Foundation's pretty simple motto, it's not always an easy task. It turns out that a lot of things don't really want to be contained, and as anyone who has tried to wrangle a feral cat can tell you, things can get pretty dicey when trying to force something into a cage. The Foundation tries to contain most anomalies they come across, for the safety of everyone, but they don't always succeed. Sometimes the anomaly just appears and disappears at will, or can't be physically contained for some reason, or much like a feral cat, it's not worth the trouble. Sometimes, though, even though they have a rat's chance in a room full of cats, the Foundation has to go after that cheese. Let's take a look. Let's start with SCP-1237, a state of electrical activity in the human brain observed in certain individuals during periods of extremely deep sleep. This state, informally dubbed Level 5 sleep or Epsilon wave sleep, is profoundly difficult to awaken the subject from. Experiments with loud noise, bright lights, chemical injections, electrical stimulation, oxygen deprivation, physical injury and mutilation, and something redacted, all failed to waken the subject. The ability to exhibit this level of sleep is controlled by a gene present in an extremely small percentage of the total world population, but certain ethnic groups might possess over 1% among their number. The majority of individuals with this gene will experience at least one 1237 event in their lives, with a single-digit percentage of them experiencing two or more. The majority of events occur when the subject is in their late teens to early 30s. Whereas those without the gene do not exhibit REM activity during the deepest stages of sleep, those with it do. Dreams experienced during a 1237 event are not of a significantly different nature compared to normal dreams, and the subject has no apparent control over the settings or events of the dream or their actions therein. When dreaming during a 1237 state, however, the brainwaves responsible for REM activity and 1237 activity interact to produce a reality-altering effect. After an event occurs, any physical or mental changes that occur to the subject in the dream will occur to their waking forms as well. If the dream involves persons or places that the subject has personally interacted with or visited, those persons and places will be altered as well. Transformation is instantaneous in all cases that have been observed. In general, memories of people not involved in the dream are unaffected. People who encounter persons affected by an event will believe that the changes are correct and that the person has always been that way, but they will have memories that this is not the case. Attempts to reconcile this among witnesses to a 1237 event tend to result in chronic uneasiness, paranoia, and something redacted. Documented effects of events have included loss of limbs and organs, or spontaneous regeneration of limbs and organs previously lost, complete and total changes in physical appearance, gender, personality, memories, age, or species, acquisition of superhuman abilities including the ability to fly, lift extremely heavy objects, survive without oxygen, or see through solid objects, significant changes in the architecture and floor plan of buildings, of the layout of city streets, or of the appearance, characteristics, or names of landmarks, changes in the outcome of historical events the subject was involved in, individuals returning to life several years after dying, the spontaneous transformation of national governments from one form to another, such as a republic to a constitutional monarchy, or from a democratic confederation to an autocratic dictatorship, and a couple of redacted things. A very small percentage of those possessing the gene are capable of lucid dreaming, the ability to control the nature of their dreams, including those occurring in 1237 events. Of course, the Foundation tried to use one of them to destroy SCP-682, and it went about as well as you'd expect. We're given a note from a senior researcher about 1237, which reads, "It is of the utmost importance that all agents assigned to SCP-1237 containment understand exactly how dangerous this phenomenon can potentially become. We have no idea how much of our world has been changed by these dreamers in the past. A single positive, having a single dream, has the potential to change the world for the worse. What if a mortician watches a scary movie, then falls asleep and dreams their town is part of a zombie apocalypse? What if a globetrotter dreams about the end of the world? What if someone aware of our existence dreams of a world where there's no such thing as the Foundation? We're talking CK, maybe even XK level events here. As it stands right now, we don't even know how many of these people are out there that we haven't found. For this reason, I want to stress that any means necessary to implement universal DNA testing and to remove these people from the gene pool is authorized, and that there is absolutely no margin of error for mercy. When you became part of this organization, you understood that we sometimes have to do horrible things in the name of the greater good, things that make it hard to sleep at night. I must ask you to do those horrible things, and to continue doing those horrible things for as long as it takes to neutralize this threat, because it only takes one positive, who can sleep at night, to create a world where the rest of us will never wake up again. Yeah, I suppose it's a pretty scary concept, but the really scary part is that there are people out there who just dream about governments spontaneously transforming from a democratic confederation to an autocratic dictatorship. Next, we have SCP-2771, a phenomenon affecting clandestine Foundation facilities in which groups of humanoids dressed in poorly cut cloth approximations of tactical gear and uniforms attempt to abduct armed security personnel. Resistance to, incapacitation, or capture of any of these humanoids merely results in their appearance in increased numbers and at additional facilities. They only communicate by insistently pointing their index and middle fingers, or through nonverbal cues indicating annoyance, frustration, or disbelief. They will alter abductees' clothing to roughly resemble their own using chalk, paint, and sackcloth, before transporting them by unknown means to a desert area containing a toll booth and a transportation system similar in appearance to an undulating human tongue. Subjects are then required to sit in the toll booth and engage with passing travelers for 8 to 12 hours before being returned to their facility of origin. Failure to interact with travelers using the appropriate protocols results in the subject's ejection and return, with the humanoids being highly agitated. They will then proceed immediately with an additional abduction attempt. Although no direct communication of proper protocol has ever occurred, trial and error has resulted in Procedure 366 Tutela, significantly reducing ejections. Personnel within the toll booth should remain inside of it until removed. Humanoid travelers will approach alone or in pairs, sitting upright upon passing bulges of muscle. Pointing should always be conducted with the index and middle finger extended and the thumb resting on the curled ring finger. If the traveler presents a laminated photo ID, personnel should consume any amount of it, wrap the remainder in foil, and return it. It's noted that IDs have been described as crispy and bitter. If the traveler presents any amount of currency, they should slide it away under their forearm, then point in the direction of travel. The humanoids will then divide any currency equally with abductees if possible. If the traveler presents any other object even remotely bearing their likeness, personnel should stare at it for approximately 15 seconds, return it, and point in the direction of travel. If a traveler begins to peel the skin from their own face, beginning with the lower eyelids, personnel should non-verbally indicate impatience before pointing in the direction of travel. If the traveler approaches holding any dinnerware or glassware aloft, personnel should lick their finger and repeatedly rub the edge of the dinnerware or glassware. If the traveler then does not respond, non-verbally indicate frustration and then point in the direction of travel. Otherwise, proceed normally. Lastly, if the traveler smiles, personnel should engage them with their sidearm. The transportation system will then distend into a helix and engulf any injured or terminated travelers. Traffic will then resume. Yep, I think that's appropriately weird enough. Next, we have SCP-2165, which is a pretty short one. The object class is None, and the containment procedures state that SCP-2165 is to be left to its own devices. It is not to be acknowledged in any way outside of this reference. This reference is to be kept in an extra-temporal, extra-spatial location. All is as it has been. All is as it always was. As for what it is, the description just says that SCP-2165 is irredeemable. It is unknown if it is a sapient entity, a non-sapient creature, an inanimate object, or a metaphysical concept. This has been deemed irrelevant by containment personnel. It has performed an action or a series of actions that caused it to be considered beyond absolution by universal consensus. The exact nature of this action or actions has since been erased from causality by universal consensus. As such, neither 2165 nor any information about it are ever acknowledged by any other being, object, force, or concept. The addendum just states that there will be no forgiveness. Jeez, they must have caught a researcher watching Mr. Beast or something. I think it's interesting that this is even an SCP document at all, which suggests that the Foundation weren't the ones that wrote this up. Why bother cataloging something that isn't acknowledged by anything in existence? It's also, of course, interesting that they consider this thing to be uncontained, when universal banishment seems about as complete a form of containment as possible. I guess we'll never know. Moving on, we have SCP-1715, an anomalous entity that sporadically joins and integrates itself into small online communities, such as message boards and wiki databases. It uses a different name on each website it joins, but every recorded username chosen has either included a redacted word or been thematically linked to something redacted. All efforts to trace its source have failed. It is currently unknown whether it is a corporeal entity accessing the internet from a physical location, or an incorporeal phenomenon that exists only on the internet. Sort of like Reddit mods. It describes itself differently from manifestation to manifestation, but always claims to be between 15 and 30 years of age. It typically targets small but growing web communities that are centered around video games, television programs, musical groups, and similar interests. It primarily targets English-speaking communities, although manifestations on non-English websites have also been documented. It has proven capable of manifesting on as many as 9 websites at once, but it's unknown if this is the extent of its limitations or merely the highest number of cases observed by the Foundation. For the most part, it uses proper grammar, punctuation, and spelling, with only occasional errors, and displays a high level of knowledge surrounding the topic of the website it is participating in. That is pretty anomalous. Other members of the online communities frequented by it generally consider it to be affable, polite, enthusiastic, and helpful. Because of its attractive personality and active level of participation, it will often become a highly respected user on websites within a relatively short amount of time. On a number of occasions, it has been promoted to positions of authority by site administrators. It begins to show its actual anomalous properties once it has established itself as a presence on an online community, usually within 8 weeks of its initial join date. At that time, it will send a number of private messages to other site members, beginning with other popular users. These messages generally begin with a declaration of friendship, followed by fabricated details regarding its personal life, and end with a request for the recipient's personal information. If the user ignores the message or responds without providing any factual personal details, no anomalous effects will take place. If the user provides it with factual information, however, the user and their account will become affected. Within 2 weeks of responding, the user will be injured in a violent incident. Such occurrences have included accidents, homicides, and suicides. Although these incidents usually result in immediate death, there have been cases of users being rendered comatose, brain dead, or similarly incapacitated. Investigations performed by local police and Foundation agents have determined all deaths to be apparently non-anomalous in nature, and explainable by forensic evidence. In one case, Foundation investigators found evidence that an individual had started planning the user's murder several years before the user had ever joined a message board. It is currently unknown if 1715 is somehow influencing these events, or if it actively seeks out individuals it knows will die. After an affected user is deceased or otherwise incapacitated, their corresponding account will remain active in its respective online communities, posting content that is consistent with the user's personality and writing style. The affected accounts possess the same memories as the user up until the time of their death, but deny that they are, in fact, dead, often accusing the inquiring party of being a troll. It will discuss the same topics as the user did, with the exception that they will occasionally post messages that could be interpreted as references to their deceased state. The account will remain active and prolific until such time that 1715 announces its departure from the website. Once this takes place, all affected accounts will reply to the announcement with various well wishes and goodbyes, before immediately ceasing all anomalous activity. Beyond their apparently symbiotic connection to 1715, there does not appear to be a limit to the amount of time the accounts can remain active. One group remained active for 11 years, analyzing and discussing episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer on a daily basis until the site was eventually shut down by Foundation personnel. I don't think you need an anomaly to have people still talking about Buffy. We're given a few examples of affected accounts potentially referencing their deceased state. One user named Tungsten, who died from falling off a balcony, posted in a thread about allergies. Another user had complained of severe sinus headaches by stating that their head starts killing them as soon as fall is over. Tungsten replies that they can sympathize with that. Another account, named Pavlov's Lemur, who died from blood loss, responded to a thread wherein users were speculating about the series finale of Lost. It stated that it just needs to think outside the box, except that it can't really do anything outside the box, as it's kind of stuck, actually, but not. Another account, named XXXLionTearsXXX, who died of decapitation, posted in a thread where users were encouraged to post pictures of what their faces look like. They replied that they don't think that's really possible for them. We're then given a log of a conversation between a Foundation agent, under the username Carmichael, and 1715, who had recently become a moderator on an online discussion board for Final Fantasy. The agent asks it for its age and location, and its real name, which 1715 says is 18, from Michigan, and its name is Brian Parker. The agent remarks that when they chatted back on the Maple Story board, it called himself Cameron Thomas. 1715 says that it's you guys again, and notes that cyberstalking is illegal. The agent asks it why it's killing people, and 1715 exclaims that it hasn't touched anybody. I believe that's the Jigsaw defense. It says that it's just a lonely guy who likes to talk about Final Fantasy and occasionally Maple Story. The agent asks what it's doing to them, and it says that it didn't hurt them or anything. Real life just kept getting in the way for them. They were always saying they wished they could spend more time online. The agent asks who it is really, and it tells him to stop. It's against site rules to harass people for their personal information. It's not going to tell him who it is, because, after all, he could be anyone. Following this conversation, 1715 created a post announcing its departure from the website. The thread received 39 responses, no fewer than 26 of which are believed to have been written by deceased individuals. It sure sounds like it's killing those people so they can be perpetually online. One minute you're just a harmless Discord kitten going about your business, and the next you're in a Final Destination movie. Let's move on to SCP-1529, a humanoid individual residing near the summit of Mount Everest, above the 8,000-meter death zone mark, where human acclimatization is believed to be impossible. It appears to be of average height and weight, and is dressed head to toe in what resembles standard mountaineering wear and boots, colored white. Its face is entirely obscured by the hood of its parka, and what appears to be an oversized pair of opaque, black mountain goggles. It has never been observed to wear any other clothes. As very few living people have observed it except through a telescope, it is not known whether its coverings are clothes or part of its body, or what it may look like underneath. The Foundation became aware of it in the 1970s, when annual expeditions to the summit of Everest became commonplace, and rumors began to circulate in the mountaineering community about a monster near the summit. Photographs found undeveloped in George Mallory's camera, a man found deceased on the mountain in 1924 after possibly becoming the first to reach the summit, indicate that 1529 was already present and active at that time, and was not significantly different in appearance than it is today. During periods when daylight is sufficient and cloud cover allows for surveillance of the mountain, 1529 is on average observable for a certain percentage of the time. Otherwise, it is inactive, and lies or sits motionless. Recorded periods of inactivity have extended from 17 minutes to possibly 8 months, with the median period being 23 days. When active, it can be observed to climb about the upper reaches of the mountain and summit in no discernible direction. It has never been observed to use any tools or climbing aids other than its hands or feet, and while traveling along established routes, it will ignore the existence of guide ropes or ladders that have been installed by previous climbers. It has demonstrated an ability to climb or descend sections of the mountain's face believed impassable to conventional mountaineers, has never been observed to fall or lose its grip, and is seemingly unencumbered by sub-zero temperatures, high winds, thin air, or low atmospheric pressure. So it's like Scott Glenn's character in Vertical Limit, which is a hell of a reference for me to make in 2026. The cause of its becoming active or inactive is unknown, and shows no correlation to weather, time of day, traffic up the mountain, season, or time of year. It has never been observed to descend below the 8,000 meter mark, except for one incident. Documented periods of activity have ranged from 3 hours to possibly 6 days, with the median being 15 hours. Nighttime observation has thus far proved impossible. Infrared imaging has shown no difference in temperature between 1529 and the surrounding mountainside. If human climbers ascend past the 8,000 meters mark while it is active, it will attempt to make its way towards them and interpose itself between them and the summit or camp. It seems to prefer to target solo climbers or climbers that are significantly ahead of or behind the rest of their group, but it will target individuals within a group if such an opportunity does not present itself. Once it is within eyesight of a traveler, it will attempt to gain their attention and cause them to make eye contact with it, which induces a hypnotic effect in the victim. The victim finds it very difficult to break eye contact, and will begin to feel very warm and comfortable, enticed to sit down and relax. Once they have stopped moving, it will close range with them and do something expunged from the record. Death from hypothermia appears to occur within 1 to 2 hours of making eye contact with 1529, much more quickly than is typical for climbers stuck near the summit. After death, victims experience an extremely accelerated state of decay, and after several hours or days, their bodies have become rotted and mummified in levels comparable to bodies that have lain on the mountain for several decades. Of the approximately 220 people who have died in the high altitudes of Everest since 1924, 1529 is believed to have accounted for a triple-digit number of them. A single-digit number of people have survived encounters with it, almost all due to another mountaineer assisting the victim before 1529 made physical contact. It does not appear to be capable of enticing more than one climber at a time, but physical encounters between it and more than one person have been noted to lead to something else expunged. The purpose and motivation for its behavior is unknown. At one point, 1529 entered Camp 5 on the northern approach at 7,775 meters, and did something expunged. In case you can't tell, this is a pretty old article. A number of casualties occurred, including both Foundation personnel operating the Camp 5 monitoring post. Foundation assets in the media attribute the deaths to a sudden storm and poor planning on the part of the expedition coordinator, who was among the deceased. 1529 had not been under observation at the time due to it being nighttime, and had not yet been located on telescope. To date, this is the first and only documented instance of it traveling below the 8,000 meter mark or entering any camp well inhabited. Sometime later, an agent in the permanent facility in China engaged in telescope surveillance of 1529 while it was active near the summit of the mountain. The agent reported that it, while facing in the direction of the base, looked directly in the direction of the telescope. The agent immediately reported symptoms consistent with a 1529 encounter, and reported that it had begun descending the mountain in the direction of the facility. The agent was unable to pull himself away from the telescope, and had to be manually restrained and sedated 17 minutes after it started, whereupon he was rushed to the sick bay and found to have a core body temperature of 27 degrees Celsius, or 80 degrees Fahrenheit, as well as signs of frostbite in the fingers and toes. Another agent found 1529 still descending the mountain and encountered similar symptoms. Telescope surveillance was discontinued for a time, when aerial surveillance confirmed that it had ceased to descend and had entered an inactive state. Also sometime later, a climber was reportedly killed during an encounter with 1529 when it abruptly became active shortly after he reached the summit. He was found alive, however, when another team reached his position nearly 2 days later, and he was removed safely. He required fingertip and toe amputations due to frostbite, but is otherwise making a full recovery. We're given an interview log between him and an agent. He says that it can't have been more than 10 minutes after he left the summit, which is the hardest part of the climb. You've reached the top, and you're exhilarated and proud, and then realize that you have to do the most difficult thing you've ever done, backwards, or you'll die. The others were 5 or 6 meters ahead of him, and that's when he saw it come over the ridge. He was surprised, to say the least, as they hadn't been told there was anyone else climbing to the top that day. He thought it must have come from the other side, or gotten left behind by its mates. He shouted and waved his hands in the air to try to get its attention. It then looked right at him, and that's when it started. He suddenly felt happy, or relieved, like all the pain and the soreness and chill was gone. He didn't have blisters on his feet, and he could feel the tip of his nose again. It was like he was back home, kicking up his feet by the fireplace. But it didn't feel right, like paradoxical undressing, where you get really cold, but your body makes you feel hot. He tried to shrug it off, but he couldn't take his eyes off of this guy who started climbing up towards him. Suddenly, he felt cold, colder than he'd been before, colder than he had a right to be. He couldn't feel his fingers or his face. His lips felt cracked and frozen. He tried to breathe, and it was like his lungs were full of water. His legs cramped up, and he was on the ground. He tried to yell for his mates, but all that came out was a whisper. He looked up, and it was still coming. It took maybe an hour for it to reach him, but he's not sure. He managed to get his arms on the ground, but he couldn't push himself up. He was starting to think he wasn't making it off the mountain at all, but the man worried him more. He started to feel something in the back of his head, something primal and menacing and hateful. When it reached him, it grabbed him by the shoulders and pulled him up to face it. He was looking right into those goggles, or those eyes, and he could see things in them, or feel things. Images and feelings in the back of his mind. Rage and joy and confusion. He doesn't think it was used to people resisting it, and it asked him a question. Not with words so much, but he saw images of people sitting back in hot tubs, laying by a crackling fire, sunning themselves on the beach. He knew their faces, faces he'd seen in books and photos, and he'd seen on the way up the mountain. He saw people still lying face down somewhere in the death zone. Its question was, "You would refuse my gift." He could barely make sense of anything that was going on, but he knew that this thing in front of him was a bigger threat than any storm or snowdrift. Moving his lips was harder than anything he's ever done, but he said, "Yes." He then saw more images of those same people lying in the snow, already half dead. He could tell he was looking at them from its perspective. It was doing something expunged to them. He could have been sick, and he could tell it was angry with him, offended and shocked. It was trying to tell him he'd been ungrateful, and he'd have to feel every minute of watching it do something to them. He asked it why it was doing this, and it mocked him. It showed him George Mallory from 1924, on his stomach and dying. He was waving and hollering at 1529 as it approached. It looked him in the eyes and it did the expunged thing to him, making him watch as it did so. He thinks watching it was worse than living it would have been. And then it told him, "Because it's there," which is a quote attributed to Mallory when asked why he wanted to climb Everest. He wasn't going to let that happen to him, so he gathered up every last ounce of strength he had and punched it in the face. Its goggles cracked, and he could see what was behind them, which was, to the surprise of no one, something expunged. He doesn't remember much after that. After his encounter with 1529, it was not observed active or inactive for 5.5 months. Upon next observation, its goggles showed no sign of damage or wear. The climber passed away sometime later, with an autopsy performed by the Foundation indicating that he had been suffering from extreme hypothermia, frostbite, and cerebral edema at the time of his death. He had retired from mountaineering following the 1529 encounter, and had not traveled more than 500 meters above sea level in the 12 months preceding his death. Sometime later, aerial surveillance picked up an image of an individual of similar appearance to 1529 near the summit of a different mountain. As the government of the country it resides in has prohibited mountaineering, the threat to normalcy is negligible at this time. Aerial and satellite surveillance of the mountain will continue on a regular basis until permanent monitoring stations can be established. So it's some sort of anomalous mountain man that hypnotizes climbers and does something pretty bad to them. I guess when I sum it up like that, it sounds pretty simple, but it's never a great thing when the Foundation suddenly finds out that an anomaly is spontaneously spreading to other parts of the world. Makes it a little tricky to contain. Let's finish with SCP-3980, which states that the former forward operating base Lock has become the de facto containment site for 3980. The above ground portions of the base have been razed. The subterranean areas have been entombed beneath several thousand tons of concrete and paved over. Physical containment beyond these measures has been deemed unnecessary. All transmissions from FOB Lock are to be disregarded. There were no survivors. Several former personnel from FOB Lock have been detained within Site 087 until the perpetrator behind the incident has been identified. Innocent parties may be released if and when this occurs. The guilty party is to be executed. The method of termination has yet to be decided. SCP-3980 is an unidentified anomaly responsible for the loss of FOB Lock and the deaths of 107 Foundation personnel on February 14, 2000. Due to its recent acquisition prior to this date, the destructive nature of the event in question, and the loss of physical documentation as well as all hands on site, its exact nature and properties have yet to be definitively ascertained. Currently, all information on 3980 has been gleaned through the first-hand accounts of the personnel who were stationed at the base and had been off-site at the time of the event. These former personnel suffer mild to severe impairment of their mental faculties and memory, possibly due to previous interaction with 3980. Despite this, all personnel are in agreement that the incident was the result of sabotage on the part of one of their number. Each suspect claims to know who this saboteur is, but are incapable of providing this information when prompted. The suspects are otherwise wholly compliant with their imprisonment. One researcher claims that 3980 is self-replicating. A security chief says that it's self-sustaining. A doctor says that it's possibly ectoentropic. Another doctor says that there may be as few as 5 instances of 3980, while someone else says that there might be as many as 10,000. Someone says that it's infectious, being transmissible between human subjects. Someone else says that it's a space-time aberration. Another that it requires a willful human operator or host or conspirator to enter an active state. Someone says that it exists in a purely metaphysical sense and is a potent informational hazard, with full cognizance of 3980 being sufficient to kill subjects, while another person says that it's physically uncontainable due to being extremely small. Another person says that it's extremely large. We're given an interview with the former director of the base, who claims to have new information on the incident. Curiously, we're not given their dialogue, just the interviewer. The interviewer asks them how they've been holding up, and the director responds that their time in custody has been relatively comfortable. The interviewer then asks about what they want to share with them, and the director explains that they've had a recurring dream of late, and they slouch in their chair. The interviewer becomes momentarily distracted by a fly, and asks them what they think the significance of this dream is. The director slouches further in their seat, and the flesh around their lips can be seen sloughing off. They begin to recount their final day on site, one day prior to the incident. They detail their remembrance of the anomaly to the best of their knowledge, as the interviewer becomes preoccupied with the killing of several more flies. Eventually, the director shouts animatedly at the interviewer, redirecting his attention, and they state three words. The interviewer expresses disbelief before he expires. Security guards enter the chamber and drag the director back to their quarters. The interviewer is led to the site morgue for post-mortem examination. Four guards were necessary to restrain him. Well, that's something. And that's the whole article. It doesn't say a lot, and yet it says more than it seems. An incident occurred at a Foundation base, resulting in 107 deaths, the subterranean areas filled in with several thousand tons of concrete, and the above-ground portions being razed. The only survivors were a handful of individuals who were stationed there, but not present during the incident. They all have proven to be wildly useless when describing the anomaly, offering completely different descriptions of its properties. In the interview with the former director, there doesn't seem to be any dialogue from them, and they begin to slouch in their chair. More alarmingly, their flesh is falling off, which doesn't seem to bother anyone. At the end, they say three words, which shocks the interviewer and apparently kills him, despite it requiring four guards to restrain him for his autopsy. The explanation, or as close as we can get to one anyways, is that the anomaly somehow causes people who are alive to appear dead, and causes people who are dead to appear alive. It doesn't affect everything around it. It requires a specific trigger, some sort of understanding. The three words that the director shared with the interviewer seem to have done it, with the popular consensus being that those words were, "I am dead." People that encounter affected corpses think that they're all alive and well, and hallucinate conversations with them, ignoring any traits that would indicate that they're deceased. The interviewer hallucinated most of the conversation with the director, and the Foundation hallucinated all of the responses from the various survivors, as they were all dead. This explains why none of their answers about the anomaly lined up. This also means that those affected by the anomaly that are still alive appear to be dead, despite any evidence to the contrary. The interviewer was dragged off for his autopsy, and the containment protocols state that there are no survivors at the base, despite them still receiving transmissions from there. It's always a curious thing in articles like these, where casual readers of the article can piece together the implications and the potential consequences. You'd have to imagine that the Foundation can surely do the same, but it's also probably a pretty tricky thing to contain. When the dead are alive and the living are dead, it's pretty easy to get things messed up. The Foundation has a fairly good track record of things, and it's not like there are many other groups clamoring to compete with them for containing all this weird stuff. Sure, there are groups that think everything should be out there and free, and the GOC is happy to put a lot of these things out of their misery, but containment is often a difficult task. After all, if it were easy, everyone would do it.